Duck South Studios in Oxford, Mississippi.
We're mass communicating.
It's a bold strategy, Cotton. Let's see if it pays off for them.
This is the End of the Line podcast, powered by DuckSouth.com.
I gave it a 10.
Sweep the leg. You have a problem with that.
And now, here are your hosts, Rocky LaFleur.
Everybody on? Good.
Great. Grand. Wonderful.
No yelling on the bus.
Josh Webb.
Sorry I had a fight in the middle of your black pants party.
And Jake Latondras.
I am bad news.
Also starring Rob Kroon.
I bet this guy's into the woods $100.
And Bradley Ramsey.
No, Mark, didn't say it.
Showtime.
All right, here we go. Hold your ears, folks. It's showtime.
Showtime, everybody! Showtime!
Welcome to the End of the Line podcast. I'm Rocky LaFleur, sitting in the Ducks House Studios in Oxford, Mississippi. It's Monday morning. We usually record this on Tuesday morning, guys. How are y'all today?
Awesome. How are you guys doing?
Doing well. It's the sun's out. Turkey season's open, and things are nice.
Well, I'm a little bit. I'm still not a Yankee, but I'm too far north for turkey season to be open for me yet. But no, we're not open yet. But the youth season just started, and I've seen a lot of kids around here killed some. And yeah, I am getting fired up. I can't wait.
Bill, I think it is unreal. I think every one of my friends at turkey hunts in Tennessee killed a turkey this past weekend. It was just, well, Facebook was full of dead turkey pictures.
It was, and I'm shocked because our weather was not exactly conducive. I was at a trap shoot all day Saturday and didn't get to hunt, and the wind was blowing 15 to 20 miles an hour. It was 68 when the sun rose, and by 1 o'clock it was 35 and raining. And then Sunday morning was just howling wind and cold. So so people must have done a good job scouting ahead of time to be on those birds. But a friend of mine had a poacher come in on him right when he was about to drop the hammer. He had five long beards, and they just flush, went up in the air. Here comes a guy walking into his spot.
Imagine that. Not, surely some turkey hunter wouldn't do that.
Well, now here's the kicker. This dummy had put a blind up on the edge of a field that was a mile from any land he was allowed to hunt on. So my buddy had seen the blind, pop-up blind, the day before season, and that's the main reason he was there opening morning, was to catch the guy. So, you know.
Well, you were talking about how that weather was. Last year, our opening day, and our opening, I think we're the 14th this year. So anyway, our opening day come out, and I hunt on the river, on islands out on the river. Now, most people won't think there's turkeys out there, and I shouldn't be telling this, but there is. There ain't this year because we got 4 foot of water over top of everything. We got high waters up here. But last year it was opening day, and it snowed. It was snowing. I mean, snowing so hard you couldn't see. I got a turkey roosted on an island. I know where he's at. The wind's blowing 30 mile an hour, and it's about 28 degrees. And so I'm in a boat running 3 miles up the Mississippi River, and about 3 foot waves up there like an idiot in the dark and the snow blowing up there, and pulled up a turkey. And luckily I about froze to death when he come out of the tree and come and killed him. But if I hadn't been right on him and had my scouting done like you was saying, those guys, you know, I mean, there's no way I'd have killed that bird that day.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's probably about the most brutal one I've ever killed. So.
That sounds bad. I don't think I've run a boat through a snowstorm to kill a turkey.
Yeah, it was a snowstorm, and 25-30 mile an hour winds was worse, but yeah.
Ugh.
So yeah, I guess I wanted him pretty bad.
Absolutely.
It was opening day. Now, a week into it, I might not have been so anxious.
It could get easier to sleep in after you've been doing it for a few days in a row.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah.
Well, Jeff, let me say this. Congratulations on having the number 1 and 2 downloaded episode at the End of the Line podcast. Good grief.
Well, that's cool.
That thing has been off the charts.
Well, that's awesome. I've had a lot of good people send me messages and PM me and different things, you know, that said they really enjoyed it. And, you know, that's awesome. And really all I'm doing is just telling the story, you know,
You and Bill are doing a hell of a job.
Well, it's your deal. It's your deal, Rocky. Your brain
is right.
Operation.
You know what's so funny about it? I don't know if anybody paid attention to Duck South. And I, by any means, I'm on here every day. People hear my voice. I don't need any recognition, but I just thought it was hilarious. A guy posted, said, "Man, Bill, you and Jeff, y'all are killing it on this podcast." Jeff Under, guy giving the high five with no return high five.
Well, that's usually the way it works when you're the brains of the operation.
Well, you know, you're anyone doing an interview, which is kind of what this is, the best, you forget they're really there, you know?
Right.
You don't make yourself part of the story, and that's, it makes it easy. It actually makes it easier, I think, probably for Jeff to tell his story, because you can lead him into it, bam, he's on a roll. And people kind of forget a good moderator or a good interviewer is, you barely know they're there.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, Bill, what have you heard besides the comments on Facebook? Have you heard anything from anybody?
Well, I have. Like the other day, Jim Ronquist first, he called me to say, "Where do I find these podcasts?" He said, "I had them before, and now I've misplaced them," and he was on the road to judge a field trial in Missouri, so I told him where to get them, and he called later and said, "Man, those were awesome." He really enjoyed them, so that was
awesome.
A good one.
That's a big compliment from Jimmy Ronk, from a guy like Jimmy. And I'm going to give him a compliment on a lot of things here. Jimmy and I don't know if any of you guys know that, I've known Jimmy forever, and we bet at Alton, Illinois on the Lock and Dam when we were building Lock and Dam 26 in Alton. And Jimmy was a laborer out of St. Charles, Missouri, and I was an ironworker general foreman out of East St. Louis. And we put the rebar in, of course, he was doing it. And Jimmy ran around with a vibrator vibrating concrete. Now, this concrete, it wasn't nothing for him to pour on the base of that deal, a 3,500-yard pour, you know, just run through the night and whatever, you know. It was crazy.
Wow.
They were pouring 200 yards an hour. And so with this big aggregate, big rocks and stuff and tough and hard and all that, so you don't move this stuff with a shovel. So what they'd had is these vibrators, these big electric vibrators that they weighed 90 pounds. And you pack that and raise that up and down on a hose, this 90-pound vibrator, in and out of this rebar while you're walking on the rebar with all this aggregate coming out of there, rocks flying off a conveyor. And, yeah, that's what Jimmy was doing. So
that doesn't sound like fun,
Jeff. Yeah, I'm going to tell you, pretty tough bird to do that. And so, you know, all I was, you know, Jimmy was doing a lot of that, and I was telling a lot of people how to put the rebar in, you know, so we had two different jobs there. You know, a little tougher job than I did, but we got to be good friends because of hunting. We'd talk about the hunting and stuff, you know, and Jimmy was at the time, and if I'm wrong, I'm sorry, but I think he was with Primos at the time as a pro staffer and with Mossy Oak as a pro staffer at the time, you know, and yeah, we talked a lot about hunting and all that, and then Jimmy went off of that job, and I want to say he went straight off of that job, right, to work maybe probably with Rich and Tone, you know. But, that was a long, long time ago, you know. And another thing I want to say about Jimmy, I'm very, very proud of him. Man, that man lost a ton of weight and got healthy and all that. That's awesome. Very proud of you, Jimmy.
He inspired me to lose weight and try to get myself in gear, and I'm sure he did a lot of other people as well.
I hardly recognize him anymore, but yeah,
that's
awesome. It's great. That's kind of how Jimmy and I know a lot of people tell you, don't even, you know, younger guys especially, you know, have no clue that that's what he did, you know, but neither one of us had an easy career coming up, you know. We're both construction workers, you know, just dumb iron workers and laborers.
So,
we were just working so we could work long enough to go hunting.
you brought up Jim and Primos, and if anyone ever wants to get a kick, I have a VHS tape in here. It was Primos' first waterfowl tape video. And they had some footage they'd shot like a few years before they even tried to film the rest of this of Jim Ronquist with some kind of Primos flute call in a pit in Burbank, Washington.
Yeah, I know where we're up. Yeah, I know the whole deal. I've seen that.
And Jim will be the first one to tell you he can't blow a goose call.
Well, and don't get me wrong, I'm not saying Wilbur's made a lot of good things. When that flute call came out, that's when I think I touched on a little bit, you know, when I went down to Bass Pro Shops years ago, and I was supposed to work with Wilbur down there selling, and he handed me a plastic sack full of them things. They were still just gray, and all the reeds was in there and everything. He goes, "We can't make these things work." I've tried everything and whatever, and I can't make these things work. And, well, I just went back there and did a little, you know, not that I'm a genius, but that's just what we were doing at the time, you know. And I flipped, had the reeds upside down. They were bent too far down. It wouldn't make a note, you know. And I flipped them around, cut them a little bit, and filed them a little bit, and away they went, you know. So, yeah, that was, yeah, I know exactly what flute call you're talking, a little history on it, yeah.
That's cool.
Before starting to make calls, man, you worked with a lot of, well, back then they weren't as prolific as they are now. The one you talked about last week was Fred Zink.
Freddie and I had
a really close relationship.
We did, and we still do. We kind of fell apart for a while, but we still do. We got a great one, you know. He'll throw me a text message out of somewhere, and if we get together, it all happens, you know. I know Tim's funeral, you know, my gosh, his dad and Fred and myself, we sat around and laughed and laughed and laughed. You know, his dad's one of the funniest men alive, if you ever met old Fred.
Amen.
He is hilarious. But anyway, it kind of started years ago, and I was guiding in Brooklyn, Michigan, up where the race NASCAR track is up there, and we're Knutson Sporting Goods, if anybody knows where that is. It's right in that area. And it was a really good spot up there, and it was just, you know, a big, there was a sanctuary, and the guy who owned the sanctuary hated us because we had 10 or 12 pits around that whole thing. But anyway, and we had just I'd guide up there a lot, and I was doing it because I was laid off and whatever, and I'd go up there, and it was a lot of fun. I met a lot of good people up there. And so one day there was, and Tim Grounds had come up there, and the Sullivan boys, and Corey Kohler, Adam Rometta, I'm talking names that a lot of people probably don't even remember, you know, they were big names at the time, you know. One day, I'll tell you another funny one. One day I was riding around, look at the refuge. I was up there by myself, and I've been up there a lot, and I knew a guy named Todd Sabota. If that name doesn't ring a bell, that's
oh,
the guy.
Oh, yeah, Giant Killer, man.
Yeah, the Giant Killer calls, you know, which is GK now or whatever. So that's all that, you know. So Todd's a good friend of mine. He used to work some shows with us and stuff. So anyway, his buddy was George Lynch, a guy named George Lynch. I didn't know George Lynch from Adam. And anyway, I'm driving around this refuge up there one day, and this maroon Ford pickup with about a dozen Bigfoots in the back of it I could see, and this guy comes around there with this kind of reddish hair up there, and he's like, "Follow me," almost. I'm like, "Who is this?" I just figure it's a Fed. You know, I always told him, he looked like a Fed to me. So finally, I stopped along the road and talked to him, and it was George Lynch. So that was the first meeting I had with George. We're great friends this day, you know. So, yeah, just a lot of stuff happened right around that time. George just, he was after them geese and following us around, trying to figure out where we were at. It's a funny deal. So, but anyway, one day I was up there, and there was a bunch of hunters coming out on a weekend. And Sonny Jackson, the guy that ran the thing, said, "Hey, we got a guy coming in. I want you to find a place." He said, "There's a place over by the refuge over." He said, "Then them geese are stacked up there." I said, "Yeah, I know where you're at. I ain't been over there. I've just kind of left it go." He said, "Well, leave it go. I got a guy coming in here." He goes, "I got Fred Zink and his dad, old Fred Zink, are coming in. And put your dog away. They got their own dog. And Freddie's got a little camera, just a little bitty Walmart camera at the time, you know, whatever. Wasn't a big camera. He wants to film this and whatever." So that was pretty much my first meet. And Freddie wasn't very old. And that was about my first meeting with Fred and his dad, and that's where the relationship formed, is right there. And we killed our limit of geese, and they had their dog, and got a little. He's probably got that video somewhere to this day, but yeah, that was our first deal, and then hunted with him for 3 or 4 days, and he come up there guiding, and yeah, it's we had a blast up there. So yeah, that was where we met. It was right up there, and go ahead.
But was Fred, had he moved into goose calling at that point? Because he started in duck, I know.
Just started, yeah. But that, he'd went to and I met, he went into the duck and did very well. And I may be wrong with this, and Bill, you probably know, but he went down there just a kid and got fifth in the world. I know. I think he got.
I think he actually either fifth. If he was either fourth or fourth runner-up, which is...
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
Yeah.
And I remember they were really into this, and his dad was the one who pushed him. You know, I mean, they both got all the drive in the world. So they run their own construction company, and both of them. I mean, anything they touch, you know, they do it with perfection. And so I know Freddie had... old Fred had taken him, I think, to Wendell Carlson's. And Wendell had, for like 5 or 6 days, and Wendell had critiqued him. And, you know, Wendell was like a music teacher, you know, and he taught you something. You know, you got it. You know, you had to get it. And so Freddie at the time was selling Carlson calls, duck calls. And I bought one of them Bayou Choke deals off of him, I remember, when he was up there. And then he got into goose calling, and old Fred just told this story the other day. He goes, yeah, or here at Tim's funeral, he was telling me the story. He said, he goes, yeah, and I've heard it from him 10 times before. He says, yeah, I seen this duck call. It wasn't way to go. We need to get in this goose call. And he said, so we're going to do this. We're going to go all the way. So that was the drive that his dad had for him, you know. And so they got, you know, Freddie with Tim and spent a lot of time with Tim. And, I mean, if Freddie put his mind to something, and you know this as well as anybody, Bill, if he put his mind to something, you know, he ain't stopping until he's number one at it, you know. He's perfection.
Yeah.
And he's a very driven person, you know, and that's awesome. But so he got on that fluke call, and I'll say to this day, there's a lot of guys that's good on it. He was the master on it. I'd say he was the master of the flute call by far, you know, and I don't think Freddie, and I hated this for him. I don't think I know he didn't. He never did win the world on it, but I'll put it this way, he very well should have. I sat there and listened to him, and he should have, but because he was the most talented on that, you know, and when he did not like to lose. Nobody does, but ooh, he didn't like to lose. But yeah, so he did very well on fluke calling. Usually it was either, you know, it was just always fun when you'd call. I took more second place finishes to him, you know, and I always say Ricky Bobby's got it right, you know, second place is the first loser, and I took more second
it
place
hurts.
Finish Freddie than anybody ever. So
it's,
yeah, he was good.
It's maybe cool the first time you finish second, but it's all downhill from there.
It ain't no good after that. Yeah, it's not any good after that. But yeah, when you're two of you standing up there and they said, well, with so many points and they name your name, it ain't fun because nobody's thinking about you. They're just cheering for the guy they know just won, you know. So yeah.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, and nobody remembers who got second. So, but anyway, long story short, we would, you know, so we kind of evolved from that point and we got to be friends, got talking a lot and all that, and it got to the point that every night we spent an hour on the phone at least every night talking duck, goose hunting, you know, whatever, and then that evolved from that to us, you know, Dawn and we all traveled everywhere together to calling contests across the country, and you know, I was around when his first kid was born, and Cole was little when he was there. I mean, it's just been kind of a, you know, a family thing. I mean, really, really close relationship. And even when he started his club up there, he had a club. Most people probably, a lot of people probably don't remember that or know that. But at one time, he ran a goose club up there, and he called me and said, is there any way, we were going to Maryland to a contest, and to a goose calling contest, and we were going to drive out there. And so he said, is any way you can come a day early? I want to show you a place. So went up there a day early, and we went up to a place he had, him and his dad were thinking about buying. It was 25 acres right next to a refuge. And anyway, we went up there and looked at it, and he said, what do you think? And I said, it'd be nice if you put up a couple ponds on there. So long story short, they developed this in the end into two ponds, and they were, Freddie was running a bulldozer for his dad, and they were working construction, they had a construction company going, so they had hired me, and I'd come up and run all the hunters all September, and they had a lake house, and I'd stay up there, and so, yeah, we had a, you know, a real good time, you know, and Freddie come up on a weekend or whatever, but, yeah, it was,
I'm sitting back and imagining these phone calls between you and Fred. Good Lord. I've been lucky enough to hunt, be in the blind with Fred one time. The guy is a walking encyclopedia of waterfowling.
Yeah, if he decides he wants to know something, that's like carbon, you know. I mean, when he got into the carbon thing up there, man, they just went wide open into it, you know. And he was into it, his dad's into it, his wife got into it, they all did, you know. And we go out to Maryland, we go to the Ward Museum looking at decoys, and they'd check them all out and all this. It's whatever he got into, and it wasn't just him, his dad. His dad is amazing, you know. If you saw the old classic cars and trucks and stuff his dad has built, you'd be amazed. He's got one right now. I don't know if it's a Ford truck, Chevy truck, what it is. I mean, it's unbelievable. I mean, it's ridiculous. And I mean, they're all hot rods, you know. And I mean, when Freddie was a kid, you know, he had a Toyota with 40-inch tires on it, you know, and all jacked up and a hot rodest one of all, you know, around the area. So they've been into stuff like this their whole life, you know. And when they do something, you know, they've done it with perfection, and they're very successful at their business, so they could do that. So, yeah, so it's really, it's funny how they've anything they got into it, you know, you knew it was going to be good, you know what I mean? So, yeah, I got to brag on him. Those conversations.
I think that drive caused some father-son friction at times when they were trying to work together.
Oh, my gosh. I wasn't going to go there, but Benji, you did. I've heard more feuds. I mean, screaming, hollering match with them guys. It's crazy. They love each other to death. But it's even hard. You can ask Dawn. It's even hard to sit down at the dinner table with them both, you know. But don't mess with the other one because the other one's on top there. You know what I'm saying? I mean, they've got that kind of relationship.
Yeah.
You know, they're so competitive with each other. You know, and I don't want to say hard-headed or just strong in their feelings, you know, because they both have figured it out, and they've just got two different ideas how to do it, and either way it'll work, you know. So,
right.
It's like that calling, you know. He was not going to stop until he knew, you know, how to get that thing right, you know, and win with it. So,
yeah.
But, he's a good guy. And then, yeah, so we went on from there, and our deal was we went around we were around the country basically for Tim, and then Freddie had a little catalog. I don't know if you remember that or not, Bill, or not.
I want to stop this just a second. Hold on.
Okay.
So you were blowing for Tim before Freddie was, or y'all kind of got there about the same time?
Did it at the same time. And we didn't know each other at the same time. You know what I'm saying? We didn't meet each other until later on. You know what I'm saying? Until a few years later. You know, probably about, you know, probably around the same time. And when I say blowing for Tim, I'd probably blowed his call for a long time before I ever started blowing, his call for competition.
Right.
But, we were both blowing for Tim. That's how we met, actually, you know. And we met up there in Michigan, but he was blowing Tim's call at the time. So
y'all really, really got close. I mean, y'all.
We've always been like brothers, you know. Yeah, we were. It was like I was like his older brother, you know. So yeah, I was. We always were like that.
But I jumped in there when you were talking about the putting up the magazine. But go ahead.
Well, the first thing that happened was Tim, like I said, I talked about that before. Tim didn't like to do shows. He just didn't like to do it. He liked to go to the shows and talk to everybody, do whatever, but he didn't want to be behind that booth. He didn't like that. You know, he would and was very, very good at it, you know, the way he talks to people and all that, and he's an attention drawer, you know, Tim always was, you know, the people would go there, but it wasn't his favorite thing to go do shows. And it does. I mean, if you do it after so many years, you know, it gets old. I mean, it's not what you're just looking forward to go doing. But anyway, right. So Freddie and I started doing this, and oh my God, I tell you a lot of funny stories about this, you know. Tim had a lot of faith in us of what to do, and like if Tim decided, I'll tell you a quick little story. If Tim decided that he needs this new hat come out and a new logo, somebody designed him. He'd be like, hey, Bob, we got to have these hats. We got to get these new cornfield hats with this new logo on there. I'm telling you what, they're gonna eat them up. They're going to love these deals. We got to get a bunch of them. Well, you and I would probably order 4 to 5 dozen. He'd order 40 dozen. I mean, he did everything extreme, you know. But I will tell you one funny little story about it. So what I'm getting, so he would send to these shows, he would send a big, giant box. And it would just be all kind of stuff thrown in this box. And when you got there, you spent 2 hours sorting this all out, you know. Sometimes stuff you put together, hey, you guys handle it, you know. And it would be hats and this. And he'd come up with koozies and beer koozies and little lights that you push your button at a light on. So Tim Grounds can't be up calls. He'd have a little call warmer thing. It was a neoprene thing that went on. He had every gadget gimmick in the world. He bought into all this and had all this stuff. And we're like, dude, we can't sell all this stuff. We want to sell cars, you know, but we'd have it and have everything out there. So in 19, Bill, you may remember this. I want to say it was 97, 96. I don't know what it was. The SHOT Show was in Atlanta that year. And I had drove Tim and I drove together to Atlanta, and I did the driving. Anyway, I drove down. But in the meantime, when I picked him up, went to his house, we jumped to his Suburban, and took off. He goes, "Hey, bub, stop at the post office. I got to mail some stuff." So we pull in the post office, and he's in there a half an hour. I'm like, "Dude, what are you doing?" You know, he got out. He goes, "Hey, I got the deal of the century." He goes, "You heard of these Beanie Babies? This new deal, and Beanie Babies is out." And I said, "Yeah, Freddie's mom." Collects them things, and she hides them upstairs so Freddie's dads don't know she has them. And she buys all kinds of loves these she's ate up with. He goes, "Hey, they got a goose one out now." He goes, "Hey, I just bought 5-6 dozen of them," something like that. "I just ordered a pile of them for this lady in there." I said, "Okay." So I'm thinking, there we go. Now we're selling goose Beanie Babies. So we'll fast forward this a month or two down the road. So we're at a show, and we get this box full of stuff and open it up, this giant box full of Beanie Babies. The key to, and I don't know much about it, but I guess the key to a Beanie Baby being a collectible was the tag on it. Leave the tag on it. Well, the tag was a cool thing, but Tim signed every tag. So he ruined them for a collector that didn't want them, you know. So, wow. So we had a table full of goose Beanie Babies he had signed on that. I mean, it got the dangest stuff I ever seen. That guy was into it. He had more innovations and stuff like that. And Freddie and I would just die laughing at all the stuff, you know, that he had, you know, like that. It was
has anyone else in the call business done a do-rag like he did?
Oh, no. He had do-rags. There you go. He had goose do-rag. You know, he had a do-rag because he liked riding motorcycles, so he had do-rags. And had a goose do-rag. And then what else did he have? That's a good one. He had those visors that have the fake hair on top of them.
Yeah.
Yeah, he got them. He's got a whole bunch of them. He got camouflage lingerie. He bought a guy out, had all that stuff. He's had a lot of different things like that. He's had a lot of that stuff. And then, but the best thing he did out of all that was 50,000 Bibles, you know, and I've got one in my car yet today, you know, so that was the best thing he did out of all that stuff, I think. But
Yeah,
but he was never scared to try something. That's all I'm getting at. So, but anyway, go back to the story. Freddie and I just, you know, we thought that was, you know, hilarious. We'd get all that stuff. And to this day, he goes, "Hey, dude, you got that Beanie Babies?" You know, we'd laugh about it, or do-rags or whatever. And so, yeah, we went around the country selling all this stuff. And Freddie then come out with a little paper book, like a magazine, and started a little mail-order company thing. And that's how he actually got started doing that. And that was his big start into the business was when he started that. And he would sell, you know, 99% of it was two things. It was mostly Tim's stuff, and that would be Final Approach stuff at the time, and I don't know. Then when I had my calls, you know, first come out, of course they were all in there, you know, and all that. And then Duck Commander. Duck Commander, that's right. I forgot. Yeah, we sold Duck Commander stuff too. Yeah, we did that too. Yeah, we had anything from $120 down to $10. You know, we had it all. So we had quite an array of stuff on the table when we were selling it. But yeah, we did a lot of those shows together like that then.
I can remember seeing y'all sitting behind that rack.
Yeah. Yeah, we used to do that, and there wasn't a whole lot of people doing it at the time, you know. There wasn't a lot of people doing those shows, you know. And we went to a lot of different ones. I'm trying to think of the last one we did together. I can't remember where the last one was, and then we kind of split off and went our own ways. And I know probably the next question you're probably going to ask is, like, when that was.
I'm a time-like guy.
I want to say 99. Around that time, I'd started making my calls, and then he come out with his duck call. But he's come out with his duck call, same come out with my duck call at the same time. And I think I told that we sold them out in Memphis at a DU thing, and that's when we come out with them. And then we got together after that, and he was going to build the a short read, and that's kind of when we split up. He built the. He was going to build a flute, and he ended up building a short reed, and that put us in competition against us and that. And Bill, you probably know more about this than I do. That was about the time when we were at the SHOT Show in, I don't know what year that was, and I know Matthews was there selling boat blinds, I think, at the SHOT Show, and I want to say in Vegas, probably. And anyway, he got with Freddie to build made him a deal to make a layout blind, the finisher. Do you remember that, what year that was?
Well, the finisher
be 98,
conversation,
maybe.
I believe, happened SHOT Show in 01.
Oh, really?
Maybe in 2000, but 2000 it was in New Orleans, and I don't think that was the year.
It was in Vegas.
So it was probably 01, and we were actually hanging around Mossy Oak's booth.
Right.
We didn't. Avery stopped doing a booth. I was a sales manager in 2000 at the New Orleans show, and that was the last SHOT Show booth Avery had.
I got you. Yeah, okay. Well, wherever it was, where he got to him, and I can't remember. I thought it was before then, but I don't know. Whenever it was, I know it was a big, hard decision for Freddie. He'd call me and said, because Freddie was all, you know, selling Final Approach stuff, and those two had went in together and made bags, and Ron Latchell and him made bags and stuff, you know, together. And so then I know, I think Matthews got to him to build a finisher blind or build a layout blind, and so Freddie started building that. He called me, and he said, "What do you think?" He goes, I can't already turn this down. I said, "Man, you need to call Latchell and tell him." And so, anyway, I guess, I don't know how it exactly happened, but anyway, Latchell had called me and said, "Hey, what's going on? What's going on at that SHOT Show?" You know, he asked, and that's another one. If I wasn't talking to Freddie for an hour at night, I was talking to Ron Latchell every night.
Ron Latchell.
Latchell, my gosh, he'd call you. Ron Latchell, for the guys that don't know, is the guy who's the creator of Final Approach. And as far as I'm concerned, he's the creator of the layout blind. And so very, very innovative person, and a great guy. I've had a lot of fun with him, and a lot of funny stories with him. Freddie and I both have. And then so Freddie decided to do this, and I just cut the story on that kind of a little bit. That caused a lot of friction between everybody. You know, I don't blame Freddie for doing it. You know, that was the start of his major part of his career. And I don't blame Ron for being mad, you know, because they were in business again, you know, but that's just the way this works, you know. And somehow I'm in the middle of this deal. So I stuck with Final Approach and stayed with there, and Freddie did that. And then that's kind of about the same time that it all split, and we kind of went our separate ways.
I'll throw in a quick one that came around that time. Before Fred and Tom ever met about the blind, evidently there had been some feelers put out, which, understandably, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And Tom called me in his office and was like, "What do you think of this Fred Zink guy?" I like Freddie. I'd known him for several years from those shows, you know, seeing each other at shows. And I said, "I like him, good guy." And he said, "Let me tell you what that so-and-so said." Okay. And evidently a dealer had called a year or two before, and Final Approach had brought in. It was a dealer who was carrying Avery blind bags and, you know, all the different stuff we had. And evidently Fred and Tim took some Final Approach bags into this dealer's, and the dealer's like, "Well, what's the difference between them and these Avery bags that I'm doing pretty well with?" And Fred said, "These were designed by real hunters." and you can imagine how that got, it gets to any of us, especially the first time or two you hear something like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Oh, yeah, I know all about that, yeah.
I said, "Well, whatever, man." But I think he's a good guy. So, and that was about a month before we met at SHOT. So,
well, I Matthews gave me a lot of cousins before I ever went to work for you.
Yeah,
and that's kind of, and that goes on further, you know. And then we were in competition with each other, you know, with calls. You know, I mean, Freddie brings his calls.
How'd that go over, Jeff? When the short read goose call that he was making was in competition with you, how did that conversation go over between you and him?
Well, I'm not going to get into all the nitty gritty of it, but basically, you know, I thought he was going to build a fluke call, and I already had a short read, and then the guy turned the calls, the same guy's turning my calls, and I'm talking to him one night, and I said, "How's Freddie's call doing?" He goes, "Freddie's fluke call doing." He goes, "Well, he ain't building a fluke, he's building a short read." And that's kind of where, you know, at the beginning of your business when you're doing something like it, you're so just driven and, you know, and all this, it anything hurts, you know. So you don't want no competition, you don't want anything. I don't know how to explain it, but being friends and all this here, and you know, and I'm not saying Freddie didn't do wrong. He did the best thing ever by doing that, because if he'd have belled a flute call, it would have sold good, but nothing like a short read would at the time. You know, short read was what was coming. The flutes were still in, and he still winning contests with them. So, yeah, he could have sold a lot of them, but they were on their way out. And a short reads are on the way in. And he's smart enough to saw that, you know. So,
Jeff, I'm going to say at that time, I bet you were a tough, hot-headed SOB.
Well.
I do not mean that in a negative way.
Well,
I'm going to say that whole goose calling crew was around that time.
Yeah, it's a pretty tough crew. around that time, yeah, it was a pretty tough crew. Now, you got to understand, here I just come from all these years as a, you know, as a iron worker, crawl up on beams and 60, 70 pounds of iron around me and fighting non-union contractors all over, and that's all I'm not going to go into detail about that, but at that time, it was a real fight. It wasn't just talked about stuff, you know, at the time. I mean, it was a battle back in them days, you know. And so, yeah, you had to be halfway tough and did a lot of stuff you're not too proud of. But, you know, we did what it was to keep our work, you know. But so, yeah, you're pretty tough, and coming out of that, this was easy compared to that, you know. But then you come out of that with that same attitude, you know, like you're not stealing my work. You follow what I'm saying? And then you come into this, and then And that's what I've always said, you know, pros and cons about unions or whatever, and I know there's all different pros and cons on everything, but there's pros and cons on it. But what I know is this. Out of our union local, there might not have been, there was 300 or 400 ironworkers in a union local that I was in, and you might not have liked two-thirds of them, and 100 of them might have been lazy, and you might not have liked them or whatever. And when you go to union meeting, there might be 50 of them. When they went to grab a cigarette, you'd see a pistol in their. I mean, it's pretty tough ones. But one thing about it, like them, lump it or whatever, but when the crap came down, you knew they were on your side. No matter what, you could trust them all. You could trust them all and give them your wallet, and you're going to get, you maybe get 50 cents back. You know what I'm saying? I mean, it was, that's just the way I lived my whole life. And my dad was, so I just trusted everybody like that. And boy, when I got in this business, it's cutthroat as it gets. I didn't understand that. And so when you find out that it is, and you get burned a couple of times, yeah, it's pretty, you get, like you said, you get pretty tough and hot-headed, you know. So,
yeah, anyway. Here's my thing. I'm imagining, and this is nothing against Fred, because I know you and Fred are best friends now. And
oh, we're great.
But at the time, when you find that out, if you're sitting here listening to the story, I want you to think of your best friend right now. Your best friend is coming out in competition with you in the same market.
Well, same the time market, it same, is, you know, model. But I get it. He's trying to do his thing, you know. He was doing his thing, and he was winning, and he was doing whatever, you know. So yeah, I mean, but the time is tough. It's tough on me.
It's got to be tough.
But he had every right to do what he did. I don't blame him at all.
Yes.
Anyway. And I'm glad he did. I'm glad he did, you know, and he went off and did great and did whatever, you know. And he's done wonders for the waterfowl world, you know, with all the you know, decoys and all the stuff he's just come up with, you know. So, very, very smart.
But Jeff,
let me
ask you this: did y'all ever talk about starting something together as close as y'all were?
Yeah, we talked about it. You know, we talked about it several times of going off and doing this on our own and doing this together. And that was about the time this was all happening, you know. And you know, and he'd done the thing with Ron Latshaw with the bags, and then I was probably there. I was Final Approaches, probably number one guy out there. I was for years. You can ask Latshaw about it, you know. For a long time, I was the only one, well, Bill remembers this, I was the only one carrying his blinds and stuff to every show in the country, you know.
Yeah.
And, my gosh, I couldn't tell you how many of them sold. But anyway, yeah, so we were all like, yeah, Latshaw would have helped us in any way at the time also, you know, had we done something like that, you know. So yeah, it was and when Whistling Wings, I think it was 5, come out, we'd met with Cuz Strickland at the SHOT Show, and that was at that Atlanta show. And
okay.
Anyway, we'd met there, and that was when the Super X2s first come out. We went over, and Browning gave us ones that didn't even have serial numbers. They were hand-scribed on there, you know, to use for that show. And it was fun. It was a fun time because I remember all we had to do is walk up to a booth and say, hey, we're doing Whistling Wings 5 this year, or doing most of it, a lot of it, you know, and they'd hand us stuff, you know, sponsors would. So it was a really fun time.
If people did not grow up in the 90s and mm-hmm. understand the impact of Whistling Wings, see, everybody wants to jump on Duck Commander. See, mm-hmm. I blame a large influx of waterfowlers into the world on Whistling Wings, the video cassettes
mm-hmm.
and DVDs,
yeah.
but also on the show that used to be on TNN, Whistling
mm-hmm.
Wings.
Yeah.
Man, that was huge.
Yes, it was. It was a major. It was the only thing. It was the only thing going. I don't know if anything else was on waterfowl.
Until 94, you'd been dealing with 30-day duck seasons.
Exactly.
So.
Mm-hmm.
There wasn't as big a market, and obviously there wasn't as good an opportunity to film.
No, and if nobody was doing it, I mean, just
yeah.
absolutely nobody was doing it. And back then, also, you got to remember this, you know, cameras were is just ridiculous how much a camera was. You know, if you'd get, I just sold, and you'll laugh at this, I just sold to an auction guy. I had one of Realtree's beta cams, giant, great big beta cams. I guarantee you that thing was $30,000 to $40,000 at the time, and I sold it for $100. You know, I probably should have just kept it in the shop for an antique. But you know, things were high back then.
Wow.
Editing equipment was $200,000, and that's when $200,000 was like $1.5 million now. You know, I mean, you couldn't just pop on the internet back then and learn how to edit. You know, you just couldn't do that. You know, you had to have editing equipment. On this was a very, very expensive time to be filming. Also, you know, so. And the cameras weren't little. They were big, so they were hard to hire.
Right.
You know? And nobody knew how to film. and especially waterfowl. Waterfowl, I don't, you know, I give everybody kudos for all the great deer and turkey and all that, but I filmed that stuff, and it's, you're not even the same ballpark as waterfowl.
No,
you know, trying to film waterfowl, it is tough.
Years ago, I remember meeting a cameraman from, I forget which network, but he was the guy who followed the golf ball on the PGA tee.
Yeah.
You know, and I'd say that's in sports, that's the toughest shot to get. And the guy was a duck hunter, and he kind of equated it. And said, you know, that's why there's just not good waterfowl video. The cameras are tough to do it with, and, man, they're hard to follow.
They're hard to follow.
Cavs hated it. I mean, all those Mossy Oak guys, they loved having y'all come along. You know, anyone that would give them footage that they didn't have to shoot.
Yeah, and that's what Realtree did at the time. I was, you know, they didn't even have waterfowl at the time, you know, and they, you know, they didn't want to do it. You know, same reason, you know. They were, when they were more geared towards, at the time, more, you know, geared towards deer and turkey, you know, but they knew they had to have the, you know, so, yeah, that's, so, yeah, that was, it's a hard, hard thing, and it's even harder as a guy like me or Fred or somebody like that is finding a cameraman.
Yeah.
Because that cameraman not only has to understand equipment, which is very technical today, but he has to understand that, but also he has to, you know, he has to understand you, what you're going to shoot. And he has to take him a long time to figure you out, a long time of hunting with you, to figure you out which bird you're going to shoot, what shot you're going to call, and all this. I filmed a little bit different than Freddie does. Freddie's, and I'm not saying either way is bad or right or wrong. Freddie is more, we used to argue so much about that. He sets the tripod up, gets it up, gets everything, and he's a perfectionist. And you got a certain degrees up, down, right, or left, and that's what you're going to get. Because he wants it in there perfect. I'm the guy, you better put that camera on there. I got image stabilizer I just paid more money for in that camera. You better put that thing on your shoulder. I don't want to see a tripod till the end of the story, and you better get everything I kill. Up, behind you, around, sideways, whatever. I want to get it. You know? So I was a little tougher act to follow with that. So
it's fun to hunt with.
Yeah, we laughed and joked and whatever. Well, the main thing was I wanted that thing hit as, you know, as much as anything. You know, people watch a video, and they probably understand it more than they used to. They watch a 2-hour video, 3-hour video, and I've made both 2 and 3 hour ones. And to get a two hour video, I mean, that's a lot of hunting to get all kills in that. You didn't believe how many misses, how many bad days, good days, you know, it's like anything, you know, just to get that. So my thought was, you better not miss anything and film anything, because everything we do, because you know, somebody might say something funny, might make an unbelievable shot, do whatever. So we filmed a little bit different. And, yeah, I remember Freddie called me and he goes, hey, we got to get this film done. He goes, you got any ducks? And I said, yeah. We got some ducks up here at Heartland Waterfowl. I said, we're just pouring in there. I said, I mean, we got tons of ducks up here, and I'll save one hole for you. I'm coming this weekend. Dawn and I'll be over and bring cameraman. Okay, so he puts this on a tripod behind a pit, and I'm not kidding. We had them. It was ridiculous. And it's on Whistling Links 5, this hunt is. But it was just a screaming, man. I go, make him get that camera on his shoulder so we can get this stuff, you know. He's, I ain't getting nothing. You're calling a shot there. I said, well, you better get them. This is ducks. You know, they ain't tame ones, you know. So there was a lot of, you know, jawing back and forth, but we had a lot of fun with it, you know. I can't say it wasn't. But to get back to that, the first one, there's some goose hunting stuff that was filmed down in southern Illinois at Burns's, and, you know, and Tim was part of it, you know. Tim Grounds was a part of it, you know, and the only part I had of it is I was in a pit with Steve Derbyshire shooting some of the geese that they got in there. But, yeah, that was a long time ago when all that happened. And then, I don't know, I always said when I watched Robinson's, you know, his first ones with him and Coco.
Yeah.
That was, you know, when that come out, you know, that was a slaughter, and everybody walked that slaughter, and that's why. And I still believe, you know, that's a big part of why it's, you know, they killed stuff. People actually, you know, see that. So that was kind of what I base mine off of. So
if I remember right, they spent over $150,000 producing that, because they hired a crew with full television television cameras and whole deal, kept three men in trees the whole time.
Yeah, and that was $150,000 back then was like $1.5 million now. It was $1 million now. You know, it was ridiculous. But you know, that is what I don't care what anybody says. That's the first couple's what made them.
Yeah.
And they did an unbelievable good job of it. Shooting in
that place we talked about on other podcasts. That place they filmed the first one. You can't kill a mallard there anymore. Can't kill a duck.
Yeah.
There.
Yeah, he told me that. Phil had told me that. That's crazy. So that's what more sparked me to do it. And then everybody at the time had a 45-minute or an hour video, and I decided the first one I come out with is going to be a two-hour video, two-hour VHS. And that's when my first one came out at Game Fair, and I forget what, 2000 I think it was. And it was called Straight Meat, the video, and it was 2 hours long, and we had filmed everywhere. And I even had one in Southern Illinois where I drove a three-quarter ton Ford Super Cab with a full trailer of decoys across the ice up there to set decoys out. Yeah, it was pretty crazy. Had Quiet Riot music on there, and that was kind of funny because I'd ran into a guy. His name is Steve something. If I said his name, you'd know him. He used to have a TV show, but he played guitar. He was out west, and he played guitar and as a backup in a lot of stuff for like Quiet Riot, for Fallgat, for a whole bunch of different bands like that. And I had met him through Ron Lancio. I said, "What do I got to do to get a hold of these Quiet Riot guys? Use this song." And so I've still got that email somewhere where one of the members sent me one back, wanting to know how many I was going to sell. And he said, "Couple hundred thousand, 300,000." I said, "Dude, if I sold 20,000, I'd think I'd, you know, robbed a bank." And so he said, "Oh, no, go ahead and use the song." So that's how we started out. You know, Bang Your Head, Quiet Riot.
Wow.
So, yeah, that's how it started. And that was my whole deal. That's when the rock music started. You know, I thought, man, if I put this to rock and roll, of course, I played drums all my life. So I always wanted a rock song. So that's how my rock and roll stuff started. And as a VHS, and it's funny, when those come in, I was selling for $25 a piece, and I mean, you couldn't get them fast enough. It was crazy, because there wasn't anything out there then, you know. And but that same VHS, instead of costing, you know, it was costing you, you know, by the time you got them out, got the covers done, and got the tapes to you and everything, I mean, you had $13 in it, $12-$13 or something, you know. So it was a lot more expensive deal, you know, than it is today to do. But yeah. If you try to get $25 out of one today, they'd laugh at you.
Hey, Jeff, I want to ask you this. You made that first video. You're sitting on top of the world. Sitting on top of the world. The king of waterfowling. Dude, I can remember this time on Phil and I talk about it all the time on forums. Man, Jeff Wall's this, Jeff Wall's that. King of the world. Did you ever
imagine?
That's
when the forums exploded.
Yeah, big time. Could you ever imagine, Jeff, at that point, when you're sitting on top of the world, that 10 years down the road, it was all going to come crashing down?
No clue. No, a lot of things was different. Back then. They were getting into the nitty gritty of it now, but there's a lot.
No. I don't want the details. I guess in the way, look, your business can fall apart. Don't get me wrong. Anybody's business can fall apart.
Mm-hmm.
But in the way, did it ever occur to you that some kind of way that law enforcement could, game law enforcement could get involved in that sort of way in all?
No, because in all honesty, you know, and anybody can look this up, I never had a ticket in my life. I didn't tick for anything, you know. I take that back. I do take that back. I was sea duck hunting. I was out in Maryland at the World goose calling championship, and I went sea duck hunting with I had good friends out there. Bill, you may know them, Sean and Tara Fisher. And Tara's, God bless her, she died of Lou Gehrig's disease. Tara was named as, like, DU Waterfowl Woman of the Year several times and all that, you know. I mean, she was unbelievable. She made the first gun cases I ever made had a flagging hole on the side and all that. She sewed all those up. I used to have the camouflage call pouches, you know, that Avery, you guys made for me later on. She sewed all those up at first and all that. And she wasn't very big. And I remember we all went out and she was in a boat and she put out the decoys and everything. She had a 10-gauge shotgun, probably didn't weigh 130 pounds, you know. And we went out and we just shot a lot of sea ducks that day. We shot our limit, which we had a blast. And when we got into the bank, there's two game wardens there. And they come in, I'm thinking, well, I don't know, we didn't do anything wrong. Got my license, got everything, you know, we got our limit here and everything. So she's up there, I mean, she's in their face. And they're screaming, yelling back and forth. We ended up and we beat the ticket. But we ended up getting a ticket for too close to the bank. We wasn't in a sea duck zone. We were like 50 yards inside of the non-sea duck zone or some deal on Chesapeake Bay, whatever that is. Like, I wouldn't have a clue. You know, I don't know where he's at.
Right.
I didn't have a clue we'd ever get to bank. I didn't know where he's at. So, anyway, that's the only ticket I ever had in my life, you know, at the time. It was probably $50. I think we beat it, if I remember right. But anyway, it was nothing. So I'd never had a ticket. You know, any kind of deal, no problem. So, no, I didn't think of no problem, and we weren't doing nothing wrong, and I wasn't going to do anything because I knew we were filming, you know. So, no, I didn't have any clue. The only thing I thought, Rocky, was the only problem I thought would come is I saw that was, you know, I could see, and I was the biggest fear I had was more guys were going to start building these $150 calls and more of them come out of the woodwork, you know, and I didn't have no clue they would like they are today, but that was the only fear I had at the time.
Hey, let me ask you this. We'll close with this one, and Bill, jump in there, ask a question, and proceed with this. But at this time, we're talking 2001 to 2004 or 2005, somewhere in there, Jeff?
Yeah, 2000. In 2000s, when Sean Stahl was with me, and he won the world out with that Straight Meat Honker, and then I really started doing ads and a bunch of stuff, and that's when the video started. We built that, and you know, a lot of those guys were on that video. But that was about the time it really started.
It's kind of strange that you bring up Quiet Ride, which was a very, very popular band in the 80s, very, very popular.
Yep.
But the life of Jeff Oils at that point, you're on top of the waterfowling world. What was it like going to the contest out in public? I mean, I'm sure that tons of people are starting to recognize you from the videos. It's got to be not like Hollywood crazy life, but just you're the best of the best at that point.
Jeff, tell me this.
Go ahead. Yeah.
When you would go to Stuttgart, and those tents, of course, were full of call makers and everything else, how many times did you go to Stuttgart before you avoided walking through the tents?
Oh, I found a way around the backside of them anyway.
Yep.
It was hard to go. If you wanted to take a break, and I still to this day, I love walking around and talking to people and at different booths, you know, and just looking to show, see what's there. And when you're at that point, that's almost impossible, you know, to do.
Yeah.
You know, you really got to cognito it up, you know, to do that. But I think at the time, that's all happening, but I was so driven to sell and make it more and more and more and more and more and make this bigger and not make a mistake and you know, and try to do, and you know, that's, You know, and I was always scared there's going to be somebody there that you didn't get to talk to or see or you know, but I always tried to make sure I saw kids or, you know, whoever, you know. And the probably the hardest thing is when you got 10 people waiting to, you know, waiting in line there, and you got the one guy who wants to tell you about the three geese he killed with the straight meat honker, you know, last year. And you can't stop listening to him, but you got to get the business, you know. So it, that's probably the toughest part. But, yeah, and you were just so busy at the show selling stuff that that I don't know, you knew it was there, but it wasn't the focus, you know. You were just focused on doing everything you could to get your product right, to get it out there, to sell stuff, to get your sponsors out there, to get their banners up, to make sure they were known, and, you know, so there's a lot of pressure on you, you know, when you're, you know, at that level trying to do those shows, you know. Plus, at every one of the shows, player, there's a contest. So you're trying to win that contest, too, so that was a lot of pressure, you know, so.
Plus, you had all your guys you're trying to get right for the contest. I can remember you doing a Bull in the Ring deal outside the hotel in Easton with your guys and pointing at them. And they'd hit a part of a routine. I didn't hear the conversation. But I was like, I've never seen that. That's kind of cool.
Yeah, that was at the height of it. I think we had 165 pro stabbers across the U.S. and Canada.
Wow. Rocky, I want to say something, you know, about, because we talked about game wardens.
Mm-hmm.
Before anything with Jeff, two of the biggest names in the business had some significant issues with game wardens, and it didn't hurt their business at all. And that's Bill Robertson and Tim Grounds.
Right. Yeah, and so, that is, and I'm glad you brought that up. You know, I've never understood this. This is the part that's really been tough for me, I guess. I never, and I don't care who does. I absolutely don't care who does. And we'll go into this, but I've never even smoked a joint in my life. I don't care who does. I don't care who does the drugs. I don't care what they do, whatever. That's this never was me. You know, I'm the guy that came out of the 70s. We were the guys in a small community who those were the outlaws that did, you know. And I just never was that deal, and I'm not to this day, and you know, I'd go to my grave that way. But, you know, let's step back to what you're talking about here. And I never had a ticket before. Now, you're talking about people that had a lot of tickets, done a lot of different things and all this here. And one of the TV show, everything. You know what I'm saying? And it's just, I'd never have understood this whole deal. So I get two misdemeanors and they burnt me to cross. But it's okay, but it's kind of tough to swallow, you know.
Well, I'm excited to start the journey of that story because I think that this is the beginning of that journey through that major point of your life. But, you know, from a outside kind of spectator watching it and remembering those forums blowing up with, it was a lot of the, I'm not going to call it deception, but just rumors and gossip that weren't true.
Yeah, and that was as myself, that was the toughest part of the whole thing, you know. And you could not get the truth out. And like I step up right in front of the plate, you know, being guilty of whatever I did. You know, whatever I actually did, I'll be the first one to admit it and apologize for it. And I have publicly done that, you know, even at SHOT Show. It was part of my sentence. I had to do that. And I don't know if you were there, Bill, or you remember that or not. But
I was not.
There were several of them at the SHOT Show. There had to be, you know, I had to make a public announcement. That was part of the sentence. And I did that at the SHOT Show when I got out. And the end of October, and in January, at SHOT Show, I made a public announcement. There were several writers there, and I just didn't know who I was there. But anyway, I have no problem doing that, you know. But it was the rumors that was just hard that you just sit there and shook your head, and there was no way, you know, to defend it, you know. So
yeah.
So that was tough.
I think the thing that people will come to find out probably through this next 2 to 3 episodes of this podcast is how this with you was in the future going to affect them. that's what drives me to get this story. Because this story, yes, it is about you, but it has an it has so many fingers to grab everybody.
Oh, that's what I said at the beginning of this. You know, there's a lot of people just do not understand. This could be them tomorrow. You know, it could be them tomorrow. And that's what you really need to look hard and long at. People just kind of brush it off at what the actual charges were and what, you know.
It could have changed their waterfowling forever. It could have changed how they waterfowl hunted forever. You could have been, I'll just say this. You could have been hunting a duck or a goose like a freaking deer by yourself, sitting up there twiddling your thumbs. Because, anyway,
yeah.
I'll leave it at that.
Yeah.
It still makes me mad.
Well, it's all good. It's all done and over, you know. And it's so. And the name of this is Redemption. So we'll find. We'll at the very end of it. I'll let everybody know what the redemption meant out of this. So.
Well, Jeff, Bill, I've really enjoyed today. I really look forward. This is what you came for, the next two or three episodes. Glad we got some stories, and then there'll be a ton more inside the story as Jeff goes along. But the next two or three is what you're here for. And I look forward to
those. Yeah,
something
I want to say before we leave, Rocky, is, again, I know I said it last week, but let's say it again, you know, and I didn't say much about Freddie's dad, but and all I'm going to say is, you know, if everybody just – you know, keep Dawn, Freddie's wife, and old Fred, Fred Senior, you know, in their prayers. You know, they could sure use them. So they've all been a big, big part of this sport, you know, and that we love. And so let's just kind of keep them all in their prayers. And Freddie's going through a lot himself right now, you know, to go through all this. So just keep them all in your prayers.
Amen.
Well, guys, thank y'all again. We want to thank all of you. Listen to this edition of the End of the Line podcast powered by DuckTales.com.